Welcome to another Mother Runner. This is Sarah Bowen Shea. I am joined today by Dimity McDowell. Hello.
Hello. Welcome back to the first day of summer. I kind of think of this as the first day of summer, even though I know it's officially not. But
I think it is the same way. You know, Labor Day is not really the end of the season of summer, but it certainly marks the end. So I think Memorial Day definitely kicks
it off. Memorial Day
barbecue and all that stuff. Yep.
Break out your white shoes. Here we go.
Do people still own white shoes that aren't sneakers?
The only pair of white shoes I ever, well, I should probably own some as a kid, but I mean, the only pair of white shoes that I ever owned was for my wedding day.
Right.
Yeah. Sure. I don't know. I mean, maybe.
Yeah.
They're not my thing, but nurses own them, I think, or maybe they just wear clogs now. I don't know. I don't know.
Right. Yeah.
Good question.
They say first communion to me, but.
First communion. Yes. First communion or getting married. One of the two. Something in a church.
Yep. So I just got back from Bend. I was the MC at the Happy Girls Race, and I believe it was the seventh Happy Girls Race, and I think it was my sixth time.
Wow. You got a streak going.
I do have
better
a
than a Snapchat streak, right?
And it was I mean, I was there when I had my fractured ankle, and that was a whole lot of fun. And so this time finally we had some beautiful weather. It was actually too warm, too sunny for racing. But oh my goodness, it has snowed on us there on Memorial Day weekend. And I was there in shorts and our new badass Mother Runner tank top. So
sweet. That feels good.
It was awesome. And then usually I'm so worn out from all that I don't do a ton of stuff. Well, the family stays there in Bend for the weekend because it's a lovely escape for us Portlanders. And then you go out to the high desert. And so there is the High Desert Museum there. And Dim, you know I love a good museum.
The High Desert Museum.
And for the record,
pray tell, what is in the high sand, cactuses?
No. So first of all, you live in the high desert.
Denver's the high desert.
Well, that's considered. They definitely showed a map of the high desert, and it covers most of Colorado, and you know, like a lot of Utah and some of Idaho and eastern Oregon and Washington and. So it is an incredibly well-done museum, and it has all sorts of things. It had, Dim, you will be nodding your head on this one. The main reason I wanted to go this time in particular was because they had a special World War II exhibit.
There you go. You and your World War II.
Love
that.
So it's really intriguing. That exhibit was about kind of how the high desert played a very important role in the home front of World War II, about, you know, there's like a lot of space and it's not on the coast. And so, you know, like the Japanese it was further for the Japanese to get to. And just a lot of workers and stuff. So there's that exhibit, and then there's all sorts of animal exhibits. So they had porcupines, they had a bobcat, they have this and you'll love this too. It's they have a bird of prey exhibit, Dimity.
Oh, nice. Do they have a jackalope there?
I do not. I almost took a. Remember when we were driving across Pennsylvania and I saw that bird of prey and I yelled out, "Raptor!" And you almost ran off the road.
I've been quiet before that, and all of a sudden Sarah's like, you know, bringing out her leather gloves so she can catch it.
Right. Be a falconer. Get out the tiny little hood to put on it. So they have that, and then they also have a pioneer, like, you know, what it would have looked like back in the day in Bend back in 1904, which was staggering how pioneery it seemed. And then you think that back, you know, let's say outside of Albany, New York or something, you'd have electricity, you would probably have running water, you would maybe have a telephone, there would be cars going, you know, Model T's going by. And this, it was like, where are Ma and Pa Ingalls? It felt very, very pioneery and rustic. And so they have these docents, for lack of a better term, who stay totally in character for the most part, as if they're in 1904. And so there's
Sarah, that's what you have to do after retire. After another mother, that is going to be your volunteer job. I can totally see it. You're going to love it.
Oh my gosh, Molly and I. Molly's going to sew outfits for both of us. Oh, it's going to be fabulous.
Yes, so. I know. You're going to go back and live your Laura Ingalls Wilder dreams finally. Yeah.
So there was this, so they have this house, and it's, you know, 1904, and they have this very small bed with its hay, quote unquote, mattress, and the boy who is working in the house is 13, and I just totally want his backstory. I want him to be a hyperlink that I could click on and find out that, like, you know, I don't know, why, is, and he was this cute boy, and I was just like, why are you doing this? So he let me lie on the straw mattress.
Oh my gosh. Wow. And you went all in.
I did go all in. And then they have this area where you can play games like they played back then. And so of course they had the ubiquitous hoop, you know, from the Little House on the Prairie series where, you know, you would it's kind of like a wooden hula hoop but with flat edges, and you would run and get it kind of spinning, or, you know, running along the ground, and then you have a stick that you push at it to keep it rolling.
Yeah, that's I've seen that in Little House on the Prairie.
Oh yeah, exactly. Oh yeah, I mean, yeah. Nellie would play it. I mean, to me, it was kind of a
Natalie, because she was the rich one.
No, Nellie with that.
Oh, Nellie. No, yeah. Nellie. Well, yeah, she was still the rich one, right?
Yeah. Oh, exactly.
They had the store. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So to me, it was more. That was more of kind of a city folk because of that. Because yes. You know, it seemed like kind of an expensive thing. So, but they also had then. Okay, so you're imagining that hoop, and so imagine that it's a whole lot smaller, and then you have these wooden sticks that look like enormous chopsticks, and you have a partner, or you can play with a couple people, and you cross the sticks, you hold one in each hand, you cross them kind of down near the end, almost near, not too far from your hands, and you have the hoop on them, and then you lift your arms as you separate the two sticks, and the hoop goes flying in the air towards your partner, who then has to catch it on one or both of the sticks themselves, and, you know, then if it really goes well, it goes up around your arm. Oh my gosh, we were like an Olympic team training for this game.
I love it.
So it was Jack, Daphne, John, and then Daphne's best friend Lucy. And I mean, we would play so that it was, you know, me tossing to John, and then going the other way would be, you know, Daphne tossing to Lucy, and then we'd swap in and out, or we would, you know, just randomly be like, "Hey, John," and throw it to him. And so John was like, "Mom, you're really good at this. You could have been a professional back then."
What's the name of it?
So it's called The Game of Graces with an S at the end. And it sometimes you can tie ribbons onto it, and that slows it down. And supposedly if it like knocks against your hand, it's a little less painful. But we also found it harder to do with the ribbons on. So we bought The Game of Graces. In the gift shop. And John and I went over, we're house sitting our neighbor's house, and they have a double lot. So they have a really beautiful side yard. And, you know, yards are a little hard to come by here in Portland. And so John and I played that game, The Game of Graces, after dinner last evening. And we had so much fun.
Oh, good. I love it. It was like a fun game.
Oh, it was really awesome. It was, I mean, it's kind of like Frisbee meets lacrosse meets, I don't know, something else. It was, and, you know, it's kind of flying in the air, and there's a definitely you have to get good at doing the crossing of the thing so that it goes flying straight and doesn't flip over too many times. So it was just, I mean,
do you get more than, is it just a two-person game, or do you get more than two sets
well,
of chopsticks?
So get this. So we go into the gift shop, and each set has four sticks, so that's enough for two players, and two hoops. So in case you like lose one, it gets stuck in a tree, whatever, one breaks. And so Daphne goes, "Oh, well, we need two sets." And I'm like, "What?" She goes, "We need two so that we can play more than two at a time." Well, this game was $28. I'm like, I'm not dropping almost $60 on some game that we love today and we might never play again after about a week from now. So, I don't know. So we started out with one kit. So to answer your question, yeah, you would have to. I mean, John does like to whittle. I mean, maybe I get him some. I don't know. some.
I can't imagine those would be that. I mean, you'd have to see him, but I mean. you know, if you have two hoops, you could probably make the sticks.
The sticks would be, yeah, because the hoops would take, I mean, all woodwork requires fine skills, but I mean, I there's no way we could make the
hoops.
Well,
and to make it round, that's hard. I mean, yeah, no.
Right, that, right, that, yeah.
That's beyond, you know, yeah, sixth grade right, whittling right, skills, but sticks could work.
Yeah, so maybe I'll put John on that, because John is an avid whittler. He, I don't know if I've told you, but John is staging his own production of The Lion King in our living room. This is a multiple week project, and he's the only one so far starring it. He has tried to get a couple neighborhood kids to do it, including Bobby Strayed, or Cheryl Strayed's daughter, you know, who played young Cheryl in Wild, is one, you know, they're our neighbors. And so I'm not serious. And I'm like, hey, wow, okay, wait a minute. Invite the professional actor over to be in your production of The Lion King.
That is awesome.
So the reason I mention that is that he, for the big staff that Rafiki holds, he whittled a stick that's probably 6 feet long, and then he painted up this ball and he put it on top, like speared it through it, and he whittled so voraciously that he got a huge blister on his thumb.
Oh my gosh, wow. He is passionate about whittling. That's great.
He is. So anyway, so maybe I like your suggestion. Maybe I'll get him on the case for making some new sticks from Game of Graces. So if anybody else has played Game of Graces, please tweet me at SBS on the run, and maybe we will make a little subset of another Mother Runner.
Exactly. Game of Graces. Jackson's future Olympic athlete.
Right. Jack said last night at dinner, he's like, yeah, if mom had been born in 1904, she wouldn't have run. She'd just play Game of Graces.
I love it.
My gosh.
That's what
Yeah. So, well, so let's move on to our guest today, who is... you know, works in the sports and fitness industry, but I doubt maybe the Game of Graces industry. she is Sarah Robb O'Hagan, a well-respected business innovator who transformed both Gatorade and Equinox Fitness. Before that, Sarah was in leadership positions at Nike and Virgin Atlantic Airways. Sarah's a mom of three kids, and she's originally from New Zealand, so she has a nifty accent. But the main reason we invited Sarah on the show is to talk about the concepts in her new book, Extreme You, Step Up, Stand Out, Kick Ass, Repeat, as well as the movement she founded called Extreme You. We'll chat with Sarah Robb O'Hagan right after this speedy break. Well, from one Sarah to another, welcome to the show.
Hi, it's great to be here.
So we doubt you'll remember, but we met at Blogger in summer 2011.
I totally remember. Of course I remember. We ran together.
We did run together. Oh my gosh, you really do remember.
Oh, of course I remember. That's why I was excited to do this. I love it.
That's hilarious. Oh my gosh, yeah. So I was about to tell you that, like, we're both super tall. We were wearing these, like, total dorky matching outfits with these pink tank tops and patterned skirts.
We were. Yep. That's very right. Yeah. In fact, I may even have a photo of it still.
That's why somebody from Sparkle Athletics just posted a picture recently, and I was like, Dim and I were both like, oh, we can't do that anymore. We cannot do the matching thing. So...
Yeah, we can't. No, that's not worth it.
Good. Awesome. All right.
Okay, well, so let's get the important stuff out of the way first. So in your new book, Extreme You, you mentioned your big feet a couple of times, and I have what I affectionately term water skis. So we got to know, how big are your feet?
Okay, so I was settled in doing nicely at a nice, comfortable 10 women's, and then I had three kids and they grew, and so they're now a women's 11 or a men's 9.5 to 10.
Oh, Dim's got you beat. She wears, go ahead.
Yeah, Dim. No, we don't need to put my size out there because people, I did lots of reasons, but I've got you way beat, and so does my daughter, who is 6 months now, so she's 13.
I'm so impressed.
Yeah, she, but I mean, you mentioned that you can still wear your Labu 10s, which I'm like, they don't go up to 13.
No, they're not making those. Yeah. Yeah. So. I'm like, literally, and when I wear them, I have to squeeze them in, and it's like, I can last for maybe an hour, and then it's like, I'm done.
I'm done. Awesome. Okay, really though, so walk us through how you morphed from a self-proclaimed lazy field hockey player to a woman who has run numerous races, including Tough Mudders and triathlons and half marathons and all that stuff.
That's a great question. So, I played a lot of sports as a kid, a lot. I mean, I come from New Zealand, you can tell by the accent, mm-hmm. and luckily for me, sports for girls is just a really big part of the culture there. And I think unlike here in the US, where it's kind of girls get shuffled into one big sport called soccer, at home we had netball and field hockey and all these great sports. So playing sports was just a big part of all of our upbringing. But I do remember, yeah, I never got picked for the A team, and I finally figured out why when my coach was like, well, you're just lazy. And so I realized I had to take up running. And what really propelled me actually forward is I remember my father coming home from a business trip to America. So obviously anything that was brought home from America in those days was amazing. And he picked up a pair of Nike Air Stabs. I can still picture them. And so I was literally the first person in my school to be wearing Nikes. And they were like, you know, little cushions under your feet. So it was kind of like this thing that just propelled me to actually try and go running, because they were so fun to wear and it just felt amazing. And in those days, I had a giant, like, Walkman CD player. Mm-hmm. Can you picture that? Like, I was carrying a CD player as I was running, listening to Pat Benatar.
We've totally been there. The disc player. I mean, come on.
Oh yeah, yeah. And I honestly think it was the combination of great shoes, having music in my ears, that kind of made me realize running actually wasn't a chore. It could be really fun, and that's how I got into it.
Nice. So, Sarah, I was intrigued to find out that you were the genius who orchestrated Nike's Run Hit Wonder Race. I loved that race. I was sorry. It was so short-lived. Flock of Seagulls, English Beat. It was my slowest 10K by more than an hour.
That's awesome. That means you loved it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, I don't know if there are enough oldies out there who remember that. It was in the early 2000s, right?
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, so just talk for a second about that, because it was, oh my gosh, I loved that race.
It was so fun. So first of all, I wish I could say I was the genius, but it was a team of about five of us. I can still remember the brainstorming session when we came up with the idea, because we were under enormous pressure to come up with a running event to trial a Nike shoe, was really what it was all about. And for some reason, we were like, we're in LA. LA people are into music. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't even know how we got into the topic of bad bands from the 80s and one hit wonders. And as soon as my colleague friend Jason goes, run hit wonder, we were like, oh my God, it has to happen. But then the best part is, like, you can imagine the pitches that the team had to do to these bands, like saying, we're asking you to play one song over and over and over again for all of these runners to get past you.
Right, exactly. Oh, because we feel you only had one good song. So don't even bother, like, playing any others.
Yeah. Don't be trialing any new music on us. That is not what this is about, you know? Yeah. And I do remember the entertainment marketing team going, this is not an easy pitch, but it was so fun. And as you know, like, I think what was cool about it is that honestly, the name, everyone immediately got what it was. Yep. And so the thing sold out so quickly. It was a blast.
Yeah, yeah.
So why was it short-lived? I don't know why. What happened?
No, what happened was in Nike terms, it was actually very long-lived, because it went from the first year in LA, the second year we expanded it to a national tour, which was even cooler. Like, literally the bands went on tour to all these cities across the US. So we did that for a couple of years. But then, you know, Nike, one of the things I love about that company is that, you know, they don't sort of stay in the same place for very long. So they were like, okay, what do we do next? How do we evolve to the next thing? And so I guess other ideas must have come afterwards.
Sure, sure.
All right, before we dive into the book, I have to admit, I'm usually not much for advice books, but I really, really enjoyed Extreme You.
Oh, I'm so stoked.
Yeah, both the easygoing anecdotal writing style as well as all the advice. So well done.
Thank you.
And one anecdote I especially loved was you showing up for the first day of a new job with numbers from your half Ironman proudly still on your arms and legs. So can you please tell that story and suggest what it says about you?
I would love to also point out, you are the only podcast out of dozens that's asked me about that story. So that's amazing. Okay. Like everyone else asks about, what about when you got drunk and slept in and missed a meeting? No, but you asked me about the try. I love that. I had done my first ever half Ironman, which I've now done two, but they are like, that's as good as I'm ever going to get. And I was starting a new job. Yes. And so I completed the event, fly from LA to New York and start the new job the next day. So I was completely like crippled stiff, you know, I could barely move. And I remember like the number was on my arm and I'm getting in the shower thinking, I should scrub it off. You know, that's what most people would do. And I was like, but I'm so proud of what I just did. Like, there's no way, like this may never happen in my life again. I've got to cherish the moment. And not only did I not take the number off, when I show up to work, I remember specifically wearing short sleeves so that everyone would see it.
And a skirt, not trousers, so that they could see your calf.
Exactly. So I was like, yeah, what did you do this weekend? Because I was a badass, you know?
And you made sure you stood so that like the right side of your body or whatever is like totally facing people when you meet them.
Totally. Yeah, no, exactly. And the funny thing I will say is because, you know, most of my career has been in sports and fitness, people tend to assume I'm an amazing athlete. And I'm like, oh my God. Like I run at the pace of an ocean liner. I mean, I am so slow, but it's all about doing it. You know, it doesn't matter how good you are. It's just about getting out there and doing it.
Well, one of the things that really made me stop, I underlined it in the book when I was reading, but when you were talking about, you know, whenever you're scared or anxious about something at work, or maybe not whenever, but oftentimes, you know, the running gives you the confidence because you're doing something hard the first thing of the day, right?
Yeah, definitely. No, running has been and continues to be like, I don't know, meditation, energizing, empowering. It's so many things for me. And I do think, you know, particularly on those days, we all have them, whether you're preparing for a really tough meeting or, you know, I don't know, a tough conversation with your child, whatever it may be, there are things that moments in our lives when we get in our head and we can wig ourselves out by doing that too much. And I think when you go for a run, there's something about just the sort of just the pace of it, your body, everything, like being in that moment, that helps to calm you down a lot and helps to sort of frame your thoughts in a more constructive way. And so it has become a like absolute technique that I mark it in my calendar when I know I have big board meetings or whatever.
Sure.
That I'm going to make sure I run that morning for sure.
Yeah. Well, and so are you still, tell us about your running routine. Are you still kind of running 5 miles a day, 5 or 6 days a week? Or are you doing other things now?
Yeah, no, I do. I mix it up. I mean, it's interesting. Now I'm the CEO of Flywheel, which is an indoor cycling company. So I'm clearly doing a lot of that. But what I love is that it's a HIIT workout. And so it is really, I'm finding that it's really improving my pace and just my overall running ability. And I'm 45 now. So I'm having to sort of be a little bit more judicious with the miles. You know, like I think 10 years ago, I could just crush 1,000 miles a year without blinking, whereas now I'm like, oh, I'm starting to get sore knees, you know. So I'm definitely conscious of, I want to be able to run until I'm way into my 60s, so I'm like, I better be sure now that I'm mixing it up with other things to extend my body's ability to do so.
Sure.
No, don't limit yourself. Let's go into our 70s still running.
I'm there, sister. I am.
We're going to be the Sarah's in their 70s club. Come on, you and me,
Let's
the founding members.
It. I'm there. Yes.
Well, and you also talk about new methods of regeneration, like better stretching, more consistent sleep. I mean, has that kind of come into your life more too as you get a little bit older? Like, how has that helped you?
Yeah. I bet you ladies are the same, anyone with kids. Like when you go through the phase of having kids, you don't sleep a whole lot at the beginning.
No.
And I do think that's a time in all of our lives where, you know, you're not sleeping enough. Sometimes you're giving up workouts because you know, whether it's mommy guilt, whatever it may be. And I definitely found once I got to a place of near burnout at one point, I was in my sort of mid-30s and I just had my third child. And I realized that you have to prioritize your energy and your fitness above everything, and then you'll be a good mom, and then you'll be a good boss, and then you'll be a good everything else. And so I became much, much more disciplined in making sure I got, you know, at least 7 hours sleep a night, making sure I did get that workout in before anything else happened. And it definitely has made a big difference to my productivity.
Nice. So, and this is kind of a basic kind of dumb question, but how did you do that? Because I mean, you obviously have a ton of responsibility, right? So how do you like turn it off and say, okay, you know what? It's 10 o'clock. I got to go to bed. Okay. It's 5 o'clock. I've got to get up and work out. Like, you know, I sometimes feel like it's so hard to make that choice, even when you know it's the right thing to do.
Yeah, it is, right? And it's all about your, I think a lot of the reasons that we don't make that choice is because we are worried about letting other people down, whether that's your family, whether that's, you know, your boss, your whomever. Because I think as working moms, but actually as all moms, you have so many people pulling at your attention all the time. But in the end, it's a choice. You just have to mentally talk yourself into, I can either be pulled in a million directions and be super ineffective, or I can firstly prioritize my own energy sources and know from then on that I'm going to be more productive at getting back to all these other people pulling on me. And I think the other thing too I would say is that it's the world we live in now is we're, you know, attached at the hip to devices at all times. But it's amazing, if you just turn the damn thing off and you don't see the emails coming in, you will have a good night's sleep. If it's beside your bed and you can see the light pinging every time something comes in, of course it's going to get into your head and you're not going to be able to be as relaxed.
So that feeds into something I heard you talking about on a different podcast. You were talking about life fitness, and instead of using the term life balance. And we think it's a concept a lot of mother runners could benefit from. And it's very much in line with what we had another mother runner and our Train Like a Mother Club promotes. So could you talk about what you mean by the term life fitness?
Yeah, I call it work-life fitness, because I feel like everybody talks all the time about work-life balance. I'm always asked, like, how do you have work-life balance? And to me, it's like I don't think about it as trying to balance something. I think about that everything in my life starts with fitness. And if I am fit and healthy, I can balance and prioritize everything in my life on my own terms. And it all starts with fitness. And I think, you know, I constantly meet people who are really struggling with the balance because of the fact that they're not even like doing the first thing that matters, which is to pay attention to your own personal fitness and well-being before you take care of other people's. And if you can get that priority in the right order and really sort of get on the front foot, you'll be so much more confident, frankly, to say no when you need to say no, and, you know, empowered and sort of energized to really get after the stuff that you've said yes to.
Yeah.
All right. So you do, you suggest people should say no. And I love that. And that's pretty critical, you know, whether it's a sanity saver while you're training for a goal or when you're working on a big work project or a family schedule is really hectic. So how do you politely and respectfully say no to something? Because, you know, I mean, we moms are like over volunteers, over pleasers, over everything's.
No doubt. It's our biggest problem. No, I mean, I think I actually have been thinking about this a lot in the last 6 to 9 months, because I actually think it's one of the single biggest kind of unthought about reasons why women don't reach their full potential is they're not very good at saying no. And you have to get comfortable at like deeply prioritizing what you're trying to get done if you're going to get to the maximum of what, you know, you're capable of being. And I actually think for some women, it's hard on the kind of after the fact when people are asking you and you feel guilty. So you say, okay, I'm going to come do what it is you need to do. Whereas if you can get ahead of it and say, for example, in my life, in the last 6 months, I started a new job and had a massive book tour. I literally got out in front of it and said to everyone in my life that I care about, here's the deal. You're not likely to hear from me much over this period of time, and here's why. And then when random requests were coming in, I could quite comfortably say, hey, it's not you. I've told this to the nearest and dearest people in my life. Like, right now is a period of time where I'm focused on this one thing. When I'm done with it and I come up for air, I'll be able to take on others. So it's almost like framing what your priorities are at a moment in time and just being very direct about it. Mm-hmm. So that's not so much reacting to the request as proactively stating this is where you're at. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Nice. So we've been a little delinquent in not having you define your concept of extreme you. So could you do that and how talk about how it applies to various realms in our lives?
Yeah, like I really believe being extreme you is essentially maximizing your own personal potential, whoever you are. So it's up to you to really define it on your own terms, what it means for you. It definitely doesn't mean you have to be into extreme sports or like an extroverted loudmouth or any of the things that the word extreme might connote. It's more about really understanding A, what your most natural skills are, B, what your passions are, you know, what really blows your hair back when you get up in the morning, and putting them together so that you're spending your time and your life really playing yourself to your full potential. And I think we all know what it feels like when you're kind of playing your A game and you know that you're sort of doing the best that you can do. It's an amazing, amazing feeling. And that's really what an extremer pursues.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right. So I've got a two-part question about mantras. So your business mantra, correct me if I'm wrong on this one, because I'll admit I was listening to the podcast while I was running. So that's why I left out the work-life fitness
that
part. And is it fewer, bigger, better? Is that what it is?
Yes.
Okay. I repeated it several times while I was running during my hill repeat yesterday, so I could try to remember.
Nice.
Please talk about how that can apply to various aspects of life. And then the follow-up, the second part of that is, do you have a different mantra for when you're in the sports realm, like in a race?
That's a great question. So yeah, in business and in life, like this idea of fewer, bigger, better is that I have found it in so many companies that I've worked at where you, especially big companies, you sort of find that over time, you know, the scope creep of projects, whatever, suddenly there's just tons and tons of initiatives going on, people pulled in all directions. And when you take a step back, you're like, are we really making an impact? If we could just focus all of our efforts behind fewer things and make them much bigger and more impactful, would we not do better? And I actually find that it's a good mantra to apply to your personal life as well, because I certainly found from, you know, all the people I interviewed for my book, these very, very high profile, extremely successful people in the world, that they were masters of just being really focused on what their particular agenda was and not getting distracted and pulled in a million directions. And kind of to the conversation we just had before, that's the death of, you know, gnawing away at your own potential when you just get pulled into lots of directions instead of really focusing on fewer things and making a much bigger impact with them. So I do think it's a good mantra for business and certainly life and career. And then I think in terms of races, that's because it's funny, like the term race is just such a crack up for me because I'm never racing anywhere. It's not like I'm ever going to be in the top 10 of anything when it comes to running. But I do think, you know, I tend to personally try and focus on one big event a year that I can really rally my attention and energy around. So I guess it does play out in its own way, even though I hadn't thought about it.
Okay, good. But there's no, like, you don't say the word believe to yourself, you know, 20 times when you hit a rough patch in a half marathon, or you know, think I got this or I'm magic or something. I don't know.
Oh, that's interesting. No, it's funny. I can't say I do. I mean, I think I typically, when it gets really rough, I typically just tell myself, you know, it's not that much time. You know what I mean? Like sure. When you actually put it in perspective, as much as you're in all that pain in that moment and you're like, God, I've got a half hour to go, whatever, then you kind of go, a half hour, I can do that. You know, you just like, I usually break it down to what is the most digestible chunk that makes me know I can get to the end.
Uh-huh. That's fine. We oftentimes talk about digestible chunks, breaking things down into because we talk about like Dim and I do a talk at expos and talk about like, oh, it's too much for your brain to chew on, so just break it into little manageable bite-sized pieces. So
exactly, there you go. Yeah. Totally, it's the only way. I think that is a great like mantra really for fitness in general, like whatever level of fitness you're at. You know, people often want to get better and they look at the people better than them and it just feels so insurmountable. And it's like, no, it's not. If you break it down into tiny little steps, like you just said, if you just improve your mileage by a tenth of a mile this week, mm-hmm. you know, that in itself is a step towards the next place you're trying to get to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So there's a chapter in your book called Ignite Your Magic Drive, and in it you write, the secret of working hard is to find the satisfaction in hard work. And I read that sentence several times over because it really resonated with me, and I just started training for a fall marathon. I haven't been on a training plan for a while, and doing those hill repeats that I mentioned when I was listening to you on that other podcast, like I was doing these hill repeats and I just kind of forgot how satisfying it is to feel that sense of accomplishment and to, you know, feel like I nailed a tough workout. So please share some of the other elements of igniting the magical aspect of drive.
Yeah. No, I really got so inspired from the people I interviewed for the book in discovering what I now call magic drive. Because the funny thing is that people will often ask me, how are you so driven? And I'm like, I actually can't answer that because I think it's hard when it's something that comes quite naturally to you, like clearly does to both of you two as well. But when you ask other people about it, you can start to sort of shape what is the common thread. And for sure, what I learned is that it is about setting challenges, but they have to be just enough kind of outside your comfort zone to know that it's a real challenge that you're trying to overcome. So anyone signing up for a marathon, clearly that fits the bill. But let's say you were an exceptionally good marathon runner. That challenge may be a slight improvement in your PR. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, what is that slight thing that's pushing you beyond where you're currently at? So that definitely it's a goal. And from there, definitely a lot of people, it was about sort of publicly stating, hey, this is what I'm trying to do, whatever that may be, if it's a running event or if it's a, you know, career objective. And then because you've stated it, you sort of put yourself on the line, this drive just triggers. And it's really interesting how, you know, I think on the case of running, I can think of many times when I signed up for events that I just was so not into training because the weather was bad or, you know, whatever. But because I'd told everyone on Facebook, Jesus, I was like, now I have to do it, you know, and it just kind of kicks in. And I think it's a little bit the same with life as well, is when so many of the people I interviewed in the book, they would say to me, you know, my parents or my coach or my professor thought that this XYZ thing that I'm pursuing didn't make sense and I shouldn't do it. And it was almost like this relentless need to prove other people wrong that really triggered this drive. It's a little bit the same.
I'm curious, and this may be, I hope it's not, it doesn't feel like a sacrilegious question, but I'm just like, when we were writing Tales from Another Mother Runner, it's a book that has like 22 essays in it from a range of different writers. And one of them, I was talking to her and she was like, you know, being a badass all the time is exhausting. And I was like, that kind of hit me a little bit because I was like, it is, or I can relate to that. I'm not saying that there aren't times to be badass and times to really go for those goals. But I mean, you can't be just always putting yourself out there, or are you?
No, it's a really good question. I do believe, and I sort of concluded that in the book, is that people who are legitimate, sustaining badasses are, they tend to go through a cycle. Like I call it the extremist cycle, but it tends to be cyclical. Yeah, sure. You go through these moments where you're setting quite aggressive goals. Like, I'll use myself as an example. You know, last year I quit my job to write a book, and you know, life was actually very, very calm. I was sleeping in. I was like having all sorts of just chill time. And then I look at this year in comparison, where my God, I've probably done 3 years of work in the last 6 months, you know, and this is a very intense time. But I think most people go through that cycle, like they bite off a new challenge that comes with a very intense period of really pushing yourself out there. But then there comes a point where that becomes comfortable, that becomes mastery, and you can just chill for a little while. And I think most people do have that moment before they kick back into something new. And that's an important part of the sort of regeneration period. Like, I think if it's physical, you do need that downtime after a marathon just to let your body regroup. And if it's life and work, I think it's very similar. When you've had these intense periods, you need to then go binge on your family and just recharge in a different way. And that's what gives you more energy to go after it again.
Sure, sure. Yeah, no, yeah, that's definitely a cycle. But yeah, and I'm glad that you advocate for that. I'll admit, I got about 2/3 of the way through your book, and then I didn't get to your conclusion. I apologize. But
So one piece of advice you give in Extreme U is proper planning prevents piss poor performance. So first off, love the alliteration. Yes. And then second, it's great advice, whether we're talking a race, a job interview, or the school auction. So could you elaborate on that nugget?
Yeah, I heard this one from a football coach when we were interviewing kids, high school kids and coaches. When I was at Gatorade, we were doing focus groups, and I was like, it's such a great line. And it's just all about how, you know, let's talk about running for a second. Like, we've all done those marathons, half marathons, where we beautifully prepared. We followed the training manual exactly as we were told to. We had an amazing experience. And we've had those ones where we know we didn't train enough.
Sure.
And you show up on the day and you're dying within 6 miles and you're mad at yourself and you know why. And I think it's like, that's really what that saying is all about, is like, you cannot expect extraordinary results if you haven't planned for them and you haven't put the work and the effort in to make them happen. Because yes, I guess some people have luck, but for most of us, you really have to not only plan, but put the real hard yards of work in to get the kind of result you're looking for.
So it was interesting, the number of women in your book who are prompted towards taking chances and gaining success, partly simply by a desire to get out of the house for a few hours a day. We can all relate. Allie Webb of Dry Bar and Janet, Shamlian, is that how you say your last name?
Shamlian, yeah.
Shamlian of NBC. Yeah. You know, we sometimes feel that's what gets us to work out when we don't feel like it. If nothing else, going for a run or going to the gym is away from the craziness at home. I mean, is that a valid enough reason to go back to work or to set some goals?
That's an interesting question. Is it a valid enough reason? I think so. Yeah. I think anything's a valid enough reason to sort of, I mean, to me, what it speaks to in both of those cases is, you know, and those are two examples, but there are many other people like it. Women in particular, we're very good at sacrificing our own, you know, goals, needs, etc., for the good of everyone around us. And I think you can do that for a certain amount of time, but in the end, when you start to really feel like there's more that you have to give, there's more potential you have to explore, you have to give in to that desire, because you're actually going to end up being a better mom and a better friend and a better everything else if you're just really loving your own life as opposed to feeling resentful. And I actually got some great advice from a friend once when I was, of all things, at the Fortune Power Women's Summit. So it's a bunch of, you know, women who are in similar career working mom positions, etc. And this woman said to me, you know, it's easy to go through life feeling guilty to your kids that you're doing all these things. And she's like, you actually have to reframe that conversation. If you say to your kids, actually, I love what I do and that's why I do it, that's very inspiring for them to grow up with a role model and think, gosh, I could go to work every day and be really inspired by what I do. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you have this kind of like, I'm constantly feeling guilty because I'm not with you, well, what is that telling them about what their life's going to be like in the future?
Mm. Sure.
Yeah. That's a great way of framing it.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Yeah. Well, and Janet has 5 kids, right? And she basically went, I mean, her story was pretty interesting. Can you just kind of give that to us in a nutshell?
It's amazing. Like, she literally told me her story over dinner one night. I didn't know her terribly well. Uh-huh. And I was like, this story needs to be told. Because she literally had 5 kids in 6 years. Let's just start
there.
Oh,
I know. And
she,
yeah.
I mean, who does that? But she had been a local anchor on the, you know, nightly news within Chicago, and she then decides to have kids, and she's like, as she said, if I couldn't do my career full time, I'm going all in with kids. You know, the 5 kids in 6 years, and then 6 years later, she realizes, well, I really, really wish that I could be back in the game. I miss being a journalist. I miss, you know, the job I used to have. And as you probably know, in that industry, it favors the young. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not easy to come back after a 6-year break, no matter who you are, but particularly mm-hmm. as a female. And I mean, she told me the full extent of the story, like her agent wouldn't even return a call or like, who are you? You know, because you went off to be a parent. And she finally gets a break to do an audition, and obviously, like, you know, completely prepares better than anyone else around her, and gets the small break and gets back on the air. And then basically it was just so dedicated to it and was so willing to drop everything to, you know, prove that she could be as good as any other journalist, despite the fact she had her 5 kids at home. And, you know, today she is a national correspondent for the Today Show and the Nightly News. And she's had this amazing career. And it's just like such an unheard of comeback. And mm-hmm. I think what I loved about her story, it's such a great story for women everywhere, is it's never too late. You know, yeah. You can be a full-time lead parent for 15, 20 years. And still, if you choose to get back into the workforce, there's somewhere for you to go. It's like, don't ever feel like you can't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So you write that the best way to beat failure is to live through it enough. And that line reminded me of my pal Kelly, who just qualified for the Boston Marathon after trying 12 times.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. 12 times. Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yep. I mean, she just kept getting back up on the proverbial horse. Yeah.
That's something. Yep. That's amazing.
Yeah. And then she crushed it. I mean, she beat it by the time that she needed by like 10 minutes. You know, after missing it for like, you know, 1 minute, 2 minutes, you know, really close. And so it was, I'm in awe. So what do you believe is gained from living through failure?
Honestly, I think a couple things. First of all, it's resilience is the single biggest thing you get out of it. Because I think when you failed, you tend to think in that moment that the world is over, but it's not. It never is. You know, life goes on and you realize, whether it's weeks or months later, that you've emerged and you're still there and you're okay. And I think what comes with that is this just resilience to be willing to try again. But I think for me, even more importantly, a big thing that you learn is humility. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think particularly in the business world, it's very easy to have a great success and think, you know, you got this, but we're only as good as our most recent successes, and the world is changing so fast around us that you have to have a constant belief that you don't have all the answers, I think, in order to be really successful in the world today. And that is what humility really is. So I think if you failed a few times, you kind of have that somewhere deep down inside, you're like, it could happen again. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to listen to everyone around me and not get too ahead of my skis.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's good, is that a Kiwi phrase? Not get too ahead of my skis.
Yeah, I don't know. It must be. I tend to use it a bunch.
I like it. Awesome. Well, thank you, Sarah. You have been so helpful and so insightful. And have you been to your flywheel class today, or are you headed there later?
Yes, I did. I rode this morning. Actually, it was awesome. Great way to get back from the holiday weekend. That's for sure.
Good. Nice. Good. Well, and I want to remind people that they can keep this conversation going. You can tweet you at ExtremeSRO or head to extremeu.com to take the it's 15 question extremer quiz that I took last evening.
Yes, that's a goodie.
Yeah, yeah, very fun. Yeah, well, thanks so much, Sarah. It was a delight talking with you.
Yeah, you too. Have fun.
Take care.
Well, Dim, I just adored talking to Sarah. That was...
Yeah. She's, well, I could listen to her accent all day long, and she's just so insightful. It's funny.
Oh, I know.
I saw an article in the Wall Street Journal last week, I think, about how, you know, like it used to be like athletes, like used to hire, Wall Street used to hire athletes, especially male athletes, because they had teamwork and they knew how to go, you know, for goals, even when they get defeated and blah, blah, blah. And the reality is, you know, a lot of the jobs on Wall Street are just taken over by computers now, right? Like that's just, you know, they don't have the need anymore for, you know, people who road crew a pen or whatever. And, but I was just thinking about Sarah and how I don't think that that's going to change for women as much. Like, I don't think that's going to be such a paradigm shift because it wasn't, you know, it's not like we were channeling into one specific field. I mean, I know that men go to a lot of different places besides Wall Street, but I don't know. I just somehow feel like the fitness, the way that we think of fitness and the way that men think of sports are, you know, stereotypically different, you know? Mm-hmm. And I just think the things that she talks about, you know, are cue up anybody for success, right? You know, taking care of yourself, setting small goals.
Saying no.
Yeah. I mean, all that stuff is just... you know, and she wasn't a great athlete. You know, I mean, she was. Don't get me wrong. I mean, she's obviously a good athlete to do what she's done. But, you know, she, like she said, she's not, you know, she never made the A team in field hockey. She, you know, she doesn't stand on the podium, but she keeps going. And that's, I think, a lot of how I know our crowd and our tribe, you know, think about success as an athlete. So.
Yeah. All right. So Dim, take us to the Train Like a Mother Club. And light up our world with what's happening
over there. Light up our world. Well, so instead of going back, usually I go back and do a race report or you know, land where somebody is exactly in the middle of their training. But here is Lisa, who's in the 26.2 Going Crush the Distance, the marathon, the traditional marathon plans.
All the hip kids are in that.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. So she says, hello, lovely mother runners. I'm starting my marathon training today, just like you, Sarah, or yesterday. This was written yesterday for Twin Cities. I moved Tuesday's run to today, so I'm already juggling. So I'm already juggling like I do.
Me too. Okay.
This will be my sixth marathon, my first Twin Cities, and my first marathon since becoming a mom. I am beyond thankful my one-year-old likes a jogging stroller, and I know we will enjoy many miles together this summer. I'm a farmer who lives in rural central Minnesota, and I love that the Train Like a Mother Club will help me connect with so many of you. All the postings about Twin Cities make me think we need a post where everyone checks in, or maybe a post where we can all list our marathon, our location, and our goals for this training cycle. Thoughts? Happy training, Bammers. And so, Lisa, just I'm answering your question on air, and I'll go in and answer on Facebook as well. But we are grabbing your races, so we have that. And we have a little place on the contact us button on the Train Like a Mother Club. So we're getting everybody's races, and then we post them in the different Facebook clubs so people know if there is somebody going to their race. And the Twin Cities, of course, is a target race. So we're going to have a shakeout run, and we're going to have a gathering. What was I going to say? And we'll release all that information, and we'll get your name and everything. So. I don't know why I'm answering her question. I just like that she was starting off. I'm like already like, oh, can I help?
So I met Lisa at last year's Twin Cities, and she was, I don't know if you remember the picture, but I posted on Instagram, and it was her son who was wearing little tiny sockany running shoes, and and he had such the cute little fat baby leg, and somebody, I think it might have been you who wrote, I think that kid needs bigger socks, because it was like squeezing them. So yeah, Lisa was actually on the podcast. She was in the one about how people who work kind of atypical, as my father would say, atypical jobs, and how they fit in, you know, with kind of unusual work schedules. And so she was the farmer that was on that show.
Perfect. So welcome back, Lisa. We're excited to see you in the Twin Cities.
Very much so. Yeah. So, well, all right. Well, spots for this year's AMR run Plus Refresh Retreat are filling up fast, Dimity. They sure are. We just got a new registration yesterday because we opened up a few more slots. We were sold out, and so now there are just 4 spots left for the September in Spokane retreat, where we'll talk race prep, fueling, mental toughness, prehab, plus enjoy some great meals together and run the Happy Girls Spokane race, either 5K, 10K, or half marathon. Or if you don't feel like racing, you can be a cheerleader at the finish line and keep me company as I'm the MC of the race. Go to anothermotherrunner.com/retreat for more details and to register. Again, that's anothermotherrunner.com/retreat. And also, we're contemplating where to hold our 2018 retreats. Yes, plural. There's an S at the end of that word for 2018. We're considering, not making any promises. Like I tell my kids, I didn't promise. We're considering having a spring and a fall retreat. Chances are good we'll have the fall one on the East Coast. I can hear some people cheering for that one. There's been a lot of requests for East Coast retreat. And we're thinking maybe a mountain state in the spring. But we'd love your input. Please tweet me at SBS on the run to give suggestions or chime in on our Facebook page, Another Mother Runner. And thanks in advance. Our podcast is a member of the Acast Network, and our show today was produced in Portland, Oregon by Alex Ward from Sounds Like Pictures. Many happy miles.